bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. We're here this morning to hear the case of Hill versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The docket number is 14-1811. Who will speak for Mr. Hill?
Good morning, Chief Judge Hagel, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kevin King.
Kevin King?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and who will speak for the Secretary?
Rebecca Baird for the Secretary.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, Mr. King. And I note that you have saved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Proceed, please.
Again, Chief Judge Hagel, Your Honors, may it please the Court. Kevin King from Covington and Burling on behalf of David Hill, the appellant. With me at council table are Patrick Berkshire from the National Veterans Legal Services Program. Also with me today are Ben Block, Joe Agosi, and Drew Indorf from Covington and Burling. I'd like to begin with the three questions that the court posed in its March 29 supplemental briefing order. We're in substantial agreement, indeed, perhaps.
May I interrupt? We've read your excellent briefs on both sides. My compliments to all counsel. What does the Secretary disagree with you about, and what do you have to say about it?
I think there's potential disagreement, Your Honor, on the third baseline issue, although I've just conferred with opposing counsel, and it seems that we're in complete agreement on the framework for the baseline issue. There was some daylight, perhaps, in the briefing between those two, but it sounds like we're actually on the same page. So as far as the framework goes, Your Honor, I think there's no disagreement between the parties. The only questions in this case are, how do you apply that framework, and then there are some antecedent questions on the psychiatric disability claim, specifically whether there was an increase during service in Mr. Hill's psychiatric disability. That's a fact question reviewed here for clear error. And then there are some live disagreements between the parties with respect to the lower back claim and whether Mr. Hill presented new and material evidence sufficient to reopen that claim.
And what do you perceive the framework of the case to be, just so I'm clear?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'll walk quickly through the framework that we agree with VA on. It has three parts. The first part is that when the board determines that a claimant has veteran status, that determination is a favorable finding of fact, which this court may not disturb under the Medrano v. Nicholson decision. You'll find in this case the board's veteran status determination at pages 10 and 18 of the record. In short, Your Honor, what the board found was that Hill has a service-connected knee disability with respect to the 1997 training period, and as a result of that service-connected knee disability, the training period is active military service, and he has veteran status with respect to that particular period.
Well, so, what if we disagreed with you on that? What would be our standard of review?
Your standard of review would be for clear error. That's Bowers v. Shinseki, 26 Vet App at 205, and Struck v. Brown, 9 Vet App at 152. And I'll just note again that there's agreement between the parties and also...
Yeah, but if this is a matter of law, an agreement between the parties doesn't make any difference, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But in fact, in Bowers and in Struck, the court said that that veteran status is a question of fact. And so because it is a question of fact, a favorable determination on that is necessarily a favorable determination of fact, which this court under Medrano would not be able to disturb.
And that's consistent with congressional intent, is it not?
I believe it is, Your Honor. Yes, it's consistent with congressional intent. If you look at the definition of veteran, it's set forth in 38 U.S.C. 101.2. It says a veteran is a person who served in the active military service and who was discharged or released therefrom under conditions other than dishonorable. And so that's the law.
Well, what does it say about active duty for training? Why is that active service?
Yes, Your Honor. 38 U.S.C. 101.24b defines active military, naval, or air service, which I'll shorten just for today's purposes to active military service, as any period of active duty for training in which the claimant, and I want to make sure I get this right, was disabled in line of duty. And so in this case, we argue, and I think it's common ground,
does that extend to all disabilities? So in other words, in this case, Mr. Hill had a knee injury, and that was determined to be service-connected. Why is it that, and in essence, the claim, as I understand it, is that his depression increased because of the pain from the back injury? It was a claim for a psychological disability or a psychiatric disability, depression. And that depression was aggravated by, well, the pain from his back injury. And the back injury was his pre-existing back injury was aggravated by the lightning strike.
It's a bit of a mare's nest, Your Honor. There are a number of factors that I think are overlapping and cross-cutting here.
Is that generally correct?
I think those factors, the ones that you identified, are some of the factors, but it seems to me that there are other factors. There was an onset of alcohol abuse following the lightning strike. He was dry before the lightning strike. He started drinking very heavily afterwards. He's now again sober. The VA examiner in the 2010 compensation and pension examination identified a number of factors. The private medical records, and especially the records from Gary Mijal, who Hill saw on a number
of... that's proof of the fact that the psychiatric condition got worse. That's not the sort of the chain of events that you're trying to link together to find service connection, right? In other words, first, the back injury has to be aggravated before this chain follows. Those are all elements of proof that it got worse.
I'm not sure we agree, Your Honor, that we've got to show that the back got worse to support the psych claim. We view them as separate and independent claims. He's got a claim for psychiatric disabilities to include PTSD and depression. He's been diagnosed with depression. We see that as standing separate and apart from the question whether his lower back claim...
So that would occur from the lightning strike itself?
Yes, Your Honor. The lightning strike is, on our view of the case, the root of the increase.
I'd like to get back to Chief Judge Hagel's question, though. How do you, or what do you base your argument on that veteran status in one disability confers active duty status on the entire period of active duty for training, please?
Yes, Your Honor. That really goes to the court's second question from the briefing order. Our view is that the Biggins decision from this court and a number of others, including Paulson, Don Ellen, and Bowers, all set out a test that you would apply to come to the result that we've advocated for. Let me back up before getting into those decisions and just go through two statutory provisions that we think are really essential because they interlink. They both turn on the meaning of active military service. So the first is the definition of that term. That's 38 U.S.C. 101-24B, which, as I mentioned, defines active military service as including any, and it does say any, period of active duty for training in which the claimant was disabled in the line of duty. It's undisputed in this case that Hill was disabled in the line of duty by virtue of the lightning strike because of his service-connected knee injury. So we check that box. And then you look at 38 U.S.C. 1153, the presumption of aggravation, which states that the presumption applies to pre-existing injuries that are aggravated by active military service. So in Biggins, the court put those two statutory provisions together, and it asked a question. It asked, okay, if we're looking at a disability claim with respect to a period of active duty for training, has the claimant shown any other disability in the line of duty during that training period, during that specific training period? And in Biggins, the answer was no. And the facts actually, I think, illuminate this a great deal. The claimant in Biggins suffered a back injury during her active duty for training period, but it did not result in any lasting disability. It sort of came and went very quickly. And Judge Steinberg, in his concurring opinion, indicated that that's actually a very consequential fact, because if Biggins' back injury had resulted in a lasting disability, her active duty for training period would have qualified as active military service, and thus the statutory presumption that she was seeking to apply in that case would have applied to her separate multiple sclerosis claim. to use the majority's language, the back disability would have been any other disability sustained in the line of duty.
So you're hanging your hat on that any other language, not necessarily on the concurrence?
We're hanging it on the majority opinion, yes. We think it's a holding of the court, although the concurrences do an excellent job of explaining how that any other provision works, and I think Judge Steinberg commented on it specifically. But Judge Kramer's concurrence also mentions at the end that there is a solution to his perceived catch-22, which is if you have a separate or a different disability that's service-connected during the same period.
But, of course, in Biggins, there was only one disability, correct?
That's correct. There was
and
a
so
back injury.
We would, I mean, it's interesting that they would say that, but it's not, it's dicta in Biggins.
That's right. The holding did not turn on it, but what the court came out and said was if there had been, then
no,
it would have been. Right. And so I think Paulson and Bowers are especially helpful in picking up on the cue that the court gave in Biggins in the majority opinion and in the separate opinions. So if you look at Paulson, and this is 7 Vet F at 469, the court asked whether the claimant was, quote, previously found, end quote, to have a service-connected disability. Or if you look at Bowers v. Shinseki, 26 Vet F at 205, asked whether the claimant, quote, previously established veteran status, end quote. Of course, that's exactly what Hill has done in this case. He previously established veteran status in 2003 when he showed that he had a service-connected knee disability.
So would you say your argument is based on the plain language of the statute, or is there a gap that we have to fill, or?
Your Honor, we think this is a plain language case, but even if there is a gap to fill, we would submit, and I'm sure my friend on the other side would agree, that the Secretary's interpretation of the statute is entitled to deference and is reasonable in this case. And indeed, under this Court's Trafter v. Shinseki decision, 26 Fed App 267 at 272, the Court has indicated that the Secretary's reasonable construction of Title 38 is entitled to deference. I'll just go one step further on this point, Your Honor, which is that the Court has repeatedly linked veteran status to the availability of the statutory presumptions. If you look at Dunellen, 24 Vet App at 175, it does exactly that. And then likewise, in the Biggins case, in the majority opinion, 1 Vet App at 477, the Court said that whether or not a training period constitutes active military service is, quote, crucial to whether the statutory presumptions apply. So these are all the reasons why we're in agreement with the VA on this second issue. And if I could, I'd state briefly what we think the rule ought to be. The way we look at it, whether or not a period of active duty for training constitutes active military service, and whether or not the presumptions apply, depends on whether that training period independently constitutes active military service, that is, independently of the claim currently at issue. And so that test is satisfied here because you can set to one side Hill's psych claims, you can set to one side his lower back claims, and you can independently find that his June 1997 training period constitutes active military service by dint of his knee injury, his knee disability.
I'd like to get into, assuming we go along with your framework and construction of the statute and this case law, to get it a little bit into the facts of this case. Are you contending that there is medical evidence that the appellant's PTSD was aggravated by service, and what evidence would you point to support that contention?
Certainly, Your Honor. We do contend that all the record evidence in this case shows that there was, in fact, an increase in his psychological disabilities during service. So that's why in our opening brief and on reply we argued for reversal. I'll note, Judge Greenberg, you had found that the board had failed to give adequate statement of reasons and bases with respect to whether or not there was an increase. We're prepared to accept that conclusion, although again we argued in our briefs that we'd go one step further.
I noticed you said psychological disabilities. I asked about PTSD. Are you defining his disabilities as general psychiatric, as depression, as PTSD? What's the status?
Certainly, Your Honor. We try and use that term, psychological disability, as a shorthand for two claims, PTSD and depression disorder.
Okay, well then, can you point specifically to information regarding each of those separate psychiatric disabilities?
Certainly. So if you look at page 1694 of the record, it's a note from Gary Mijal, a doctor who saw Hill on a number of occasions.
He wasn't a doctor, was he?
He's a treatment specialist. I think
he's not a doctor.
Certified mental health specialist, yeah. MSSW is the acronym that comes after his name. I'll indicate I do not know what those initials mean, but my understanding is he's...
I believe it's a master's of social work.
Sounds right. So he indicated that Hill's PTSD and depression symptoms became, quote, much worse after the lightning strike. So I think Mijal's statement would go to both of the things you asked about, Your Honor. There are statements from members of Hill's unit who were eyewitnesses to the lightning strike and who knew Hill for many years, who gave written statements about his mental condition both before and after the lightning strike and before and after the service period. And you'll find those at 702 and 703 of the record, and I'll just give you a few quick quotations from those. One member of Hill's unit indicated that he was a totally different person, both mentally and physically, because of the lightning strike. Another indicated, quote, that he often showed signs of depression, which was very unusual for him. That's at 703. The VA examiner in the 2010 compensation and pension exam diagnosed Hill with major depression. She did disagree.
And that
he
was
had,
page, I'm sorry, do you know the page of that diagnosis?
I do not, Your Honor, although
okay,
I believe that it's covered at page 17 of our brief.
Okay.
My apologies, Your Honor.
That's fine. We'll find it.
And so certainly it seems that there's broad agreement that Hill is suffering from depression disorder. I think there is some difference in the record with respect to whether he has PTSD or whether that increased. We believe he does have PTSD and that those symptoms did increase permanently as a result of that June 1997 training period.
Is the question whether an appellant's underlying disability worsened in service a medical question or a factual question? Or something the board can determine versus an examiner can determine?
I believe that it's a fact question that the board can determine. Of course, that determination would be informed by medical evidence, whether those are service medical records or private medical records. But under the Federal Circuit's Buchanan decision, in addition, lay testimony would be appropriate in some circumstances to address whether or not there had in fact been an increase. It's going to depend on whether this is the kind of disability that a layperson would be competent to testify about, although I think depression would certainly fall within that bucket.
Do we have to consider whether this worsening, if we assume there was, that it was temporary, since Dr. Mijal talked about that his condition was moderate and then the CMP examiner discussed that his condition was mild? What do we do with that?
I'm not certain that the CMP examiner, Your Honor, said that his depression was mild. It may have been that some of his other symptoms were mild, but our view of the record is that there's very clear evidence, indeed one-sided evidence, that there was an increase in his depression, and that increase has persisted to this day. I spoke with Mr. Hill recently, and this is not in the record, but I'll just note that he is still feeling very depressed. And so if you look at pages 3 to 5 in our reply brief, I think you'll find our best evidence as to why there was a permanent increase in Hill's psychiatric conditions. I guess that if there are no further questions on sort of the framework or on whether or not there was an increase, there are two issues that I hope the court will address that have not yet been addressed in any of the opinions in this case, and they relate to Hill's request to reopen his lower back claim, which was denied in 2003 and became final that year. The question presented there is whether or not Hill has presented new and material evidence sufficient to reopen that claim. And we've got two buckets of evidence that indisputably are new, so there's just a question whether or not they're material. Judge Greenberg's prior one-judge decisions indicated that the board had failed to give an adequate statement of reasons or bases with respect to one of those buckets, which are the new lightning strike articles. These are news articles that explain common symptoms and effects of being either struck directly by lightning or being very near a lightning strike. We certainly agree that that's one way in which the court could dispose of the issue. But there's
of course, as much as I respect Judge Greenberg, that single judge opinion is not authority, correct?
That's our understanding. It's persuasive authority. This court can look to it as a panel. It could adopt it. We would certainly.
We can adopt the reasoning if we want to, correct?
That's right, but it doesn't bind the panel in any way. And that's part of the reason I'm bringing up these additional issues, which were not touched on there. So there is this question whether or not the lightning strike articles are new and material. We believe that they are, and that this court could just go ahead and actually resolve that issue. Again, they speak directly, as we explained in our reply brief, to an issue that was found wanting when Hill's lower back claim was denied in 2003. And for that reason, they're material. But irrespective of how you resolve the lightning strike articles, we think that Hill's new testimony regarding the effects of the lightning strike, the distance that it threw him, and the fact that it caused him to strike a tree are both material pieces of evidence that would speak to and are sufficient to reopen his lower back claim. And with respect to that new testimony, there really are two nested questions. The first is whether the justice presumption of credibility applies. That's Justice v. Principi. And as you know, Your Honors, at the reopening stage, the question is very narrow. The court generally presumes the credibility of new testimony, and the whole idea is to have a pro-veteran, low bar to allow these claims to go forward. It serves a very narrow purpose. This is not a through-going review of the entire record. The only exception to the justice presumption of credibility is this patently incredible exception, which the board applied in this case and which we think is inappropriate. This court in Duran, 7 Vet App 220, explained how that exception works. It works, for instance, in instances where a male claimant is claiming disabilities based on complications from pregnancy. That's a far cry from saying that a lightning strike threw me 20 to 25 feet and caused me to hit a tree. And indeed, in Duran, the court explained that the patently incredible exception applies only when the new evidence is inherently false or untrue. Inherently false or untrue, which means that you could look at it in isolation and decide, just as a male claiming complications from a pregnancy, that could never happen, right? And so you have to ask the question in this case, could it ever happen that a person would be 1 to 3 feet away from a lightning strike and be thrown 20 to 25 feet? And the answer, of course, is yes. Indeed, VA conceded in their initial answer and brief in this case that it is possible. And indeed, Hill's testimony is consistent with the rest of the record. More than 15 years ago, in February 1998, Hill explained in a medical record, and this is at page 579 of the record, that the lightning strike threw him 20 to 25 feet.
If I can interject, please. Does the rest of the record actually have any relevancy in determining whether something is patently incredible?
We don't think so, Your Honor. We think credibility ought to be assessed under justice at step two. But to the extent the VA is arguing for a contextual analysis, I'm simply saying that we think if you do look at the full context here, you'd find that it is quite credible what Hill is saying. But, Your Honor, we agree. Under justice, it's quite clear, and this is 3 Vet App at 513, that there's a two-step inquiry. And at the first, you just ask, is this new and material? You're not getting into credibility vis-a-vis the rest of the record. I won't belabor the point anymore other than to say, Your Honors, that if you find the justice presumption applies, and we urge you to so hold, then it follows that Hill has, in fact, submitted new and material evidence to support his lower back claim, and that claim should be reopened rather than just sent back for an adequate statement of reasons or bases. And so for all those reasons, Your Honors, we urge that you would reverse the board with respect to the lower back claim and that you would remand for application of the framework that we're in agreement with VA on with respect to the site claim, unless you agree with us, and again, we hope you do, that all the evidence in the record shows clear error on the question whether Hill suffered an increase in his psych disabilities.
I do have a question. They both relate to the same thing, and that is, let me just boil it down to one. In theory, I am a little concerned about the idea that the finding of disability for one disability in an active duty for training context would convey veteran status for all disabilities. And let me explain why. In active duty for training or inactive duty for training is a different factual situation than active duty. Because this period is so short, in the case of active duty for training, 2 weeks, it's important to show that an individual had no disability before they come into service, or in this case, aggravation. And then that disability was, in fact, made worse within the service. But in order, your argument, within that period of service. Now, your argument is based, however, on the presumption of aggravation. So if a person does not have veteran status, they don't get the presumption. And the reason that is important is because the period of active duty or for training is so short. So there could be an injury either before or after that period of active service, and as a result, the likelihood of the injury occurring after the period of active service, and there's a greater possibility that could occur. So doesn't it seem reasonable that an individual who has one disability and it's service connected because of injury during active duty for service, that presumption should not extend to any injury whatsoever? I see there's a problem with that. I probably haven't expressed my thought process too well, but if you can extract something from that, can you answer that question?
I see that my time has expired, Your Honor.
I understand.
Certainly. So we too have struggled with that issue, and I think let me give you our best explanation for why it makes sense to read the statute exactly the way Congress wrote it and the way all the parties agree in this case. It takes a little bit of work to get there. So one of the ideas is that for the first claim of disability, for the knee disability in this case, but in any case, for the first one, the claimant's going to have to show through direct evidence under Smith that he or she suffered a permanent disability and that it was caused by the active duty for training period without the aid of any presumptions. And if someone has run that difficult gauntlet, they come out at the end as a disabled veteran. They come out as exactly the sort of person to whom Congress would intend to make these presumptions available. And just as a matter of likelihood, if somebody has suffered a service-connected disability from, as you say, a very short period of active duty for training, then it is plausible, indeed more likely, that person may have, from the same source or cause, suffered another service-connected disability. So those are two things. I think there's also a matter of incentives, right? If somebody like Hill has 3 claims, it doesn't make any sense for that person to hold 1 or 2 of the claims back to go and adjudicate the first one and then go and try and use the presumption for the second ones, because under 38 U.S.C. 5110A, the effective date for any grant of benefits is going to be when those later claims are filed. So somebody would be leaving a lot of money on the table if they were to stagger their benefits claims in that fashion. And indeed, the VA system is non-adversarial. There are not lawyers involved at the agency level, typically. There were not in this case. There was a non-lawyer advocate from a veteran services organization. I'm blanking presently on the name, the American Legion. So those are some of the practical realities that go into your concern, Your Honor. I hope those are responsive. I'll just give you a few case-specific points also, which is that you may not need to decide that exact question here, because there's a baseline rule that the court had posited in its March 29 order and on which the parties are in agreement. And that's that you need to show a baseline for your pre-existing injury. And of course, to get the benefit of the presumption, you also need to show an increase, right? We're not asking for a free pass here. We're saying if it's shown that there was an increase during service, then you're going to get a presumption as to why the increase occurred, but you've still got to show that the increase occurred. And in this case, we think there's very clear evidence that an increase did in fact occur. And I'll just very quickly run through my best evidence of that. So if you look at page 1067 of the record, it's a memo from a doctor, Dr. Stephen Johnson, who treated Hill for many years, indicating but his depression has improved lately. Again, that's October of 95, so about 18 months before the lightning strike. That same doctor in November of 1996, or about 7 months before the lightning strike, said that Hill has done quite well over the last year and his prognosis is good. Then you've got the lightning strike occurs in June of 1997. A few months later, in October of that year, a caseworker indicates that the strike, quote, created new difficulties for Hill. That's at page 653 of the record. And I'm sorry, I skipped over one. On May 15 of 1997, less than a month before the lightning strike, Gary Mijal, the social worker we discussed before, indicated that Hill was in a new unit and he was much happier. That's at page 1414. And then finally, in January of 1998, just a few months after the lightning strike, Mijal indicated that Hill had been improving significantly prior to the accident, but became much worse after the lightning strike, which aggravated his depression and other psychiatric symptoms. So I think in this particular case, the takeaway is there's strong evidence that there was an increase that occurred in service. It may be in other cases that there's not.
Okay.
May I? One, do you believe that everything you've just said is consistent with the congressional intent in 38 U.S.C.A. 1153? A pre-existing injury or disease will be considered to have been aggravated by active military, naval, or air service where there is an increase in disability during such service, unless there is a specific finding that the increase in disability is due to the natural progress of the disease.
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that...
So this is a matter of statutory construction in the first instance as to what Congress intended. Did Congress intend with this statute to make a distinction between a reserve component member who met the requirements of the statute and an active duty member?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe Congress intended to make a distinction, and the distinction is that for an active duty for training claimant like Hill, they've got to show in the first instance, before they get the benefit of any presumptions, that they have suffered a service-connected disability, that they were injured in line of duty during that training period. That's 38 U.S.C. 10124.
But once they do that, then both are to be treated the same.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. So there's that antecedent step that the active duty for training claimant needs to take that the active service person does not, and that's the distinction. And we think, again, the Biggins case, both in the majority and in the concurrences, is the best explanation of how that works.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, do you agree with what your adversary just said?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Barrett for the Secretary. Yes, Your Honor, we do. We agree with the appellant's interpretation of 10124B in that it is when an active duty for training veteran sustains an injury during that training, he becomes a veteran for purposes of 1012, and he becomes entitled to the presumption of aggravation under 1153. If I may continue from where Mr. King left off, what we didn't get into really was how VA determines whether there was an increase in disability for purposes of that presumption.
I'm sorry, I need to ask you if you could speak up just a little bit.
1153 refers to where there is an increase in disability during such service. The Secretary contends that the Secretary's regulation, 38 CFR 3.306, which was also addressed in the Board's decision, is VA's interpretation of how we determine whether there is an increase in disability during that service. This kind of goes to Chief Judge Hagel's concerns about how do we determine whether there's been an increase on such a short period of time. 3.306B provides that such a determination will be based on all the evidence of record, including manifestations prior to, during, and subsequent to service. 3.306B has been interpreted by this court as pertaining to how VA defines the increase in disability under 1153, but I would also note, and Mr. King and I previously discussed, that 1154 is actually noted as the authority for 3.306B. 1154 also indicates that when determining whether service connection is warranted, VA should give due consideration to the places, types, and circumstances of such veteran service as shown by the veteran's medical records and all pertinent medical and lay evidence. So we believe that, kind of to allay some of the concerns that Chief Judge Hagel was addressing, the response to that is VA will broadly accept and entertain and consider evidence pertaining prior to, during, and following that period of active duty for training.
I'll ask you what I asked him. Does VA consider that to be a medical determination or something the board is capable of doing?
The court has previously held, and I apologize, I can't recall the case name right now, that a determination of whether there was an increase in disability is a factual determination.
Is your position that the statute is plain as to the question of converting this active duty for training period into active duty?
We do believe so, Your Honor. 1153 is clear on its face that it's when a veteran sustains an injury on an active duty for training period, he becomes a veteran for purposes of 101.2 and 101.24 and 1153.
And by the way, just, sorry, Chief.
I was just going to, Ms. Baird, I'm sorry to ask you this again, but I have a hearing problem, so it's...
I apologize, Your Honor. I'll lean a little closer.
Okay, thank you. Otherwise, if it doesn't disturb you, I'll actually come down here to get closer to you. No, I'm serious. I don't want to miss what you're saying. So.
Thank you.
Active duty, the statute we're talking about doesn't say active duty for training. 1153, does it?
No, it refers to active military
service.
Correct.
Right. And so we're clear in the real world, active duty for training may be 6 months. If you're a cyber specialist, it may be 6 months. If you're an infantry enlisted person, it may be another 18 months, or it may be any combination. So we're not talking about a two-day weekend necessarily or a two-week period of duty, are we? And that's probably why no specific distinction was made in 1153 between active duty and active duty for training. You're on active duty. You have to be on active duty as a reservist to qualify and meet the other requirements.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. And so the Secretary is satisfied that this issue doesn't turn on how many days or how many months or how many weeks you're on active duty. It's that you're on active duty when you sustain this aggravation of a pre-existing injury or disease. Is that correct?
Correct. It would not depend on the length of the active duty.
That's right. So the same degree of proof or proofs is required of the active duty veteran as well as the reserve component veteran under this statute in terms of establishing aggravation.
If the active duty
Congress training, intended no distinction. Is that the way the Secretary reads it?
If the active duty for training veteran has sustained an injury on that period of active duty.
That's right.
Correct.
All right. And everything that flows from that, just as everything that flowed from an injury while on active duty.
Correct. You have the active duty for training veteran who was injured on active duty for training has become a veteran for purposes of VA benefits.
So it's just a matter of proof.
Of the injury incurred during...
And that matter of proof, the same degree of proof is required of both the active duty soldier who becomes a veteran and the reserve component soldier who becomes a veteran.
Yes.
Thank you.
Now you, if I'm not mistaken, you agree that these issues should be remanded. Am I correct?
That's correct, Chief
okay.
Judge.
So what are you fighting about here? What's the difference that you object to the fact that the board decision should be reversed as opposed to remanded?
That's correct, Chief Judge Hagel.
Okay.
Mr. King just ran through a litany of evidence establishing presumably establishing that the depression increased as a result of the active duty for training period.
In order for us to reverse, then we would have to find that those factual determinations were clearly erroneous, correct?
That is correct.
And that's why we have to look at the proof overall?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it was the Secretary's position in our initial brief that the Board appeared to look at Mr. Mijal's statement as well as the VA examiner's opinion in 2010, and that's really all they discussed in determining whether there was an increase in disability. That's not quite good enough under 3.306B, which specifically states that when we determine whether there's an increase in disability, we will look to the evidence prior to, during, and the manifestations afterward. So it was the Secretary's position at the initial brief that the Board's reasons and bases was inadequate to make a determination.
Actually, I do have a question. Getting back to the back claim that the new material evidence presented, again, with regard to the testimony that the veteran provided about being thrown 25 feet, the Board seemed to weigh that evidence against prior statements by the veteran and others regarding the length of his flight and whether there was a tree involved. Is that an appropriate method for the Board to assess whether something is patently incredible?
We believe the Board's finding is supported by the evidence, Your Honor, and we do believe that the Board correctly considered the context of the prior statements.
So, unlike your counterpart, you don't believe that they only look at that particular statement in and of itself. They have to look at what the veteran or prior evidence has demonstrated with regard to that particular assertion.
Correct. Justice was issued in 1992, I believe, and since that time the court has issued Godfrey, Knightley, Reynal, and Godfrey, Reynal, and Keitley, which all address something other than just the facial credibility of the statement. Those cases dealt with medical opinions, but it's not clear why we wouldn't consider the context of the new evidence with regard to a lay statement as well. In Keitley, the court found, for example, that the medical opinion submitted as new and material evidence was specifically contradicted by the veteran's report of an injury that was previously of record. So the same analysis could apply here. I don't think it matters that it's it's not a medical opinion. It's simply the veteran's lay statement that, whereas in 1997 he said he was thrown to the ground after falling, or he was thrown 3 feet to the ground in 1998 as well as 2011, and then 2012 it was 25 feet into a tree. While it's not impossible to be thrown 25 feet into a tree, it simply can't be both. You can't be thrown 3 feet to the ground and 25 feet into a tree. It's one or the other. So we think the Board properly found his statement was incredible.
No, patently incredible. Right? Not just incredible. Patently or patently incredible.
Patently incredible was not the standard applied in Godfrey, Keitley, and Reynal.
No, I'm talking about in this case. The Board didn't just find it incredible, but found it patently incredible.
Correct. The Board statement.
Is there a difference?
Patently would indicate that on the face of the document alone, the Board made such a finding, which would not be supported by its further analysis of the evidence that previously existed.
Well, isn't it possible that something happened to this soldier, veteran, that in his addled mind condition, maybe he thought it was 25 feet? Doesn't the Board have to determine to conclude that it's patently impossible that there was no tree within 25 feet, or there were no trees because it was in the desert, or some such thing?
Or he didn't bounce 3 feet off the tree.
Right. Right. I mean, in other words, what they're doing is saying they find his later story inconsistent with the previous story. But is that the standard for patently incredible? As opposed to the example, I'm sure there are many others, that your adversary used about a male soldier saying they were pregnant.
You are correct, Your Honor. It is not patently incredible.
Thank you.
With regard to the new material evidence claim, as we've just discussed, the Secretary does agree that, the Secretary does believe that remand is warranted as to that claim because the Board applied a standard that was not correct. The Board looked at the treatise evidence and said it does not tend to show that the appellant's back was aggravated by his period of active duty for training. That is not the correct standard. So as the Secretary set forth in the initial brief, we believe that remand is warranted of the new material evidence claim so the Board can apply the proper standard.
You know, I'd like to commend counsel on both sides for the candid nature in which you have approached this case. It's very helpful to the court to see the highly professional way in which both of you have conducted these proceedings.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions?
Yes.
Thank you.
You made the statement that with regard to veteran status, that the VA has consistently taken the position that a person who is on a reservist is on inactive duty for training or active duty for training, that they are considered a veteran for all purposes.
Correct.
And where is that distinction or that lack of distinction memorialized other than your statements?
I'm sorry, sir.
Is there an instruction? Is there a general counsel opinion? Is there some document or evidence that your statement that the VA has consistently not required a separate injury on active duty to accord the presumption of aggravation for all injuries?
I am unaware of any general counsel opinion on that issue. However, I would note that in Paulson, the court specifically stated...
I'm not talking about the court. I'm talking about the VA. You made the statement about the VA's consistent application, and we can accept that. But under our, we can accept it only if there's a showing that that was a consistent application, in fact, an external showing other than your statement, that that is true, that there's a consistency, that there's a substance or a background for your statement.
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not have a list of cases on hand, but I'm happy to provide the court with that if you would like. Off the top of my head, I'm not aware, and I'm not aware of any general counsel opinion on that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'll be very brief, just three very quick points. I think on the lower back claim, on the question whether new and material evidence has been submitted, that's the standard for reopening. The VA has just candidly conceded that Hill's new testimony about the distance that he was thrown is not patently incredible. And we think it follows, as night does day, from that, that he has in fact submitted new and material evidence. His testimony must be presumed credible under justice, because it's not patently incredible, and so that would augur in favor of reversing rather than remanding on the question whether Hill's lower back claim should be reopened. So that's point number one. Point number two, if you do want to look at the Kitely and Godfrey and the other cases cited by my colleague, you can look at pages 13 to 14 of our reply brief for some responses regarding those cases. I don't know that in light of the concession it's necessary to get into that, but for the court's edification. And then Finally, earlier I blanked on the page in the record for the 2010 CNP examiner's assessment of Hill's psych symptoms. Judge Scholl, and you had asked about that. It's page 453 and 454 of the record. If there are no further questions, we ask that the court reverse with respect to the lower back claim and either remand for application of the new framework with respect to the psych claim or find, as a factual matter, that all the evidence shows an increase and thus remand for application of the presumption of aggravation.
Does the court have to accept the stipulations that you all have agreed to? Do we have to accept those?
No, Your Honor, you do not. The framework is a question of law. We do believe that you need to give deference under Trafter to the VA's considered judgment on those issues. It's interpreting the statute which it administers, and that's set forth. It's got the signatures of all the top folks from the VA General Counsel's office in their supplemental brief. So I think you need to confront the deference question. But as I mentioned, we think all of these things, the conclusions that we agree on, plainly flow from the text of the statute.
What about my question about that I asked Ms. Baird about relying on her statement, the statement of an advocate only, without any explanation about the background for that statement? Have I made myself clear?
I believe you have, Your Honor. Let me restate and see if I see if this responds to your question. Certainly, an advocate standing alone at the podium is not going to get Chevron or our deference, right? There needs to be some sort of official document. Of course, we think in this case there is such an official document, which is the Secretary's supplemental brief in this case, which gives the Secretary's position on these issues.
But isn't that the advocate who's saying that in the brief?
Well, it's the advocate acting on behalf of the Secretary, and it's done so in response to an order of this court. It's put out publicly. I think some of the matters cited in the supplemental briefs we cite in our motion for panel consideration, and also, I believe, in our renewed motion for panel consideration, a VA General Counsel opinion, which is public, available on Westfall, sure, and which may speak to some of these issues also.
Okay. Yeah, but you're an advocate, so is your adversary. You're advocating your positions, and it's up to us to interpret an act of Congress. And you're both arguing that the plain language of the statute is what we should apply here, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. We think if we were in Chevron land, this would be a Chevron step one type case. And the court has authority, indeed the obligation, to apply the traditional tools of statutory construction at step one. But if there is any ambiguity, of course, that's when deference to the VA would kick in.
I'd just like to add my concurring statement with Judge Greenberg. I appreciate the professionalism of both counsel. It's a pleasure to hear the argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, the case is submitted, and the court will agree counsel.
All rise.
Circuit. This is a practice there. It's nice that you have it as well.
Court is in recess.
Well, thank you.
Well done. Congrats on wrapping up your final argument here. Yeah, well, if you want to do a supplemental submission, it's probably not very good pieces. It's a very good question.
Looks like it's a little bit up.